You are listening to a Pleasure Podcast. For more from our sex podcast collective, visit pleasurepodcasts.com.
I'm Tristan Taramino, and this is Sex Out Loud.
That's why I'm literally writing a whole book about my gender.
My mom and I were on BBC together talking about sex work and disability, which is something I never thought I would ever do.
Where do we learn about how to react to bodily fluid?
People have abortions more than we want to admit, and abortion is beyond healthcare. It's really body autonomy.
Someone talks about porn ruining sex. The question for me is, which porn?
I don't want anybody to fetishize my Jewishness who wouldn't stand next to me at a march.
I just wanted to show polyamory in a way that looks like polyamory.
If you're excited by sexual pleasure and sexual politics, you've come to the right place.
I've been this radical queer agnostic theologian for a long time.
They think that Muslims don't have sex.
There is a very specific history of racism and anti-blackness in this country.
I don't know who started this myth that after people are sexually assaulted, they never want to fornicate again.
We really don't think that change happens without knowing what we're for and not just what we're against.
Welcome to Sex Out Loud, everyone. Today, we're going to talk about polyamory, families, community, and connection. I have a returning guest with me who, it can't be overstated, is one of the critical figures in the study and writing about polyamory and non-monogamy, Dr. Elizabeth Eli Sheff. Is a researcher, expert witness, coach, speaker, and educational consultant. With a PhD in sociology and certification as a sex educator from ASECT, Dr. Sheff specializes in gender and sexual minority families, consensual non-monogamy, and kink and BDSM. Sheff is the foremost academic expert on polyamorous families and children with her 20-plus year polyamorous family study. It's the only longitudinal study of polyfamilies and children to date. Currently calling me from lecturing at the University of Tennessee in Chattanooga. She's also taught at many different universities around the country, and she co-chairs the Consensual Non-Monogamy's Legal Issues Team for the American Psychological Association. Welcome back to Sex Out Loud, Eli.
Thanks so much for having me, Tristan. I love your show and I'm thrilled to be here.
So as I said in your intro, you have done this longitudinal study that is entirely groundbreaking. I think I had you on the show when you did The Polyamorists Next Door, which offered a lot of insight into polyamorous families. And your newest book is Children in Polyamorous Families. So I want to talk about that because, well, for one, I feel like this is really useful information about like childhood development and how children learn about families. And then I also think it sort of shuts up the red herring of, oh my God, polyamory. What about the children?
Yes. And they say it just like that too.
Right. So, and you're like, oh, you want to know? Okay. Well, here's the research, people. So what about the children in a nutshell?
I would say in a nutshell, polyamorous families are basically no different from monogamous families or divorced families or single parent or dating families in that it all comes down to how the parents handle things. Some parents in monogamous families are fantastic. They're amazing parents who communicate with each other and their kids, and they've got a really happy family life. And some monogamous families are a hot mess.
Yes.
Doesn't, you know, like being monogamous doesn't make them better. It doesn't, you know. So for polyamorous families, the stance that automatically they're messed up and they'll mess up their kids is simply prejudice. Mm-hmm. In fact, they can be fantastic for children when the parents handle it right. And by handle it right, I mean give the kids age-appropriate, honest information about it. So if a 3-year-old asks a question, you know, I've had some polyamorous parents, for instance, explain their relationships to their three-year-olds by, this is a kissing friend, and that's a friend, not a kissing friend.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
That's something that a three-year-old can understand, like a kissing friend, okay?
Right, right.
That's a different kind of friend. The kids don't understand and don't want to know about their parents' sex lives. What they want to know is, who's bringing the ice cream? Can I paint your toenails? Will you sit on the floor with me to play with Legos? That's what's important, especially to smaller children. So they tend to relish polyamorous family life because there's so much more attention for them. You know, there's always someone who will let you paint their toenails. If there's seven adults around, you know, somebody's willing to get their toenails painted. And older kids also relish that attention, but with more awareness of what's happening and more kind of choice themselves. They look at their parents establishing chosen family relations with this broad range of people, and those older kids are like, aha, I can do that too. And so when they, for instance, move out of home and go to college, for instance, they can reestablish networks of emotionally intimate, caring people that will support them because they've gained all these skills in their polyamorous families about how to communicate, how to take self-responsibility, how to recognize your needs and negotiate for them, how to respect other people's boundaries, you know, all sorts of useful relationship skills they learn in their families of origin and take forward into their lives of resilient emotional relationships. So are polyamorous families different from other families? Absolutely. But they don't have any special problems that don't face other kinds of families. For instance, stigma against polyamorous families. Other families experience that too. Gay families, divorced families, single parent families. The idea of parents leaving or having, you know, kids getting close to someone who leaves.
Mm-hmm.
Divorced families or, you know, single parent families, that happens all the time as well. So there's nothing, no problems that only face polyamorous families and don't face other families, but they do have some special benefits of, for instance, allowing parents to have multiple partners and get their sexual and emotional and social needs filled without having to divorce each other. They can have sex with other people and it doesn't have to cost them their family relationship. So I would say overall, polyamorous families can be really fantastic for kids.
So being a polyamorous parent is not a recruiting tool, is what you're saying. Like, it's not automatically going to make your kids polyamorous, but it is going to give your kids, I think, some ideas that they can make their own relationships according to their wants and needs and not just what they see sort of replicated in society, which is our society is mononormative.
Very well said. Precisely. Nicely summarized, Tristan.
Thank you. But also, I think, but then I'm also thinking about the fact that there is a model there. I think that one of the things that folks my age and even younger and definitely older struggle with, in addition to the stigma, in addition to a lot of barriers, is that we didn't grow up with models of consensual non-monogamous relationships. And so in many ways, it's like we've seen this one model replicated over and over and over again. This is what our parents did. This is what our siblings are doing. This is what everyone on TV is doing. This is what my, you know, community is doing. And so often that's one of the things that makes non-monogamous people feel isolated is because there aren't people to look to say, oh, they did it this way. Maybe we can adapt some of those qualities and some of those agreements to work for us.
Absolutely. I would say that the kids from polyamorous families, some of them are like, yeah, I definitely want to be polyamorous. Some of them are like, no way am I going to be polyamorous. Absolutely not. But the vast majority of them are in the middle of it's an option, something they may consider, something they might not. But regardless of how they structure their romantic lives, that kind of coming from a very communicative and honest background where families could talk about things, that seems to be the most useful thing. So that template, I think, transcends relationship style and just provides kind of fundamental relationship skills.
Yeah. And it also occurs to me that one of the things that poly people have to do is we sort of have to sit down and make decisions consciously, explicitly about what we want. We're not defaulting to a model of monogamy. And so we've got to be more intentional, not, you know, hashtag not all polyamorous people, but you can obviously be a dick. But many of us have to be more intentional about our relationships. Sometimes we want to name them and talk about sort of the limitations of them, the boundaries, all that stuff. And it occurs to me that the people I know who have been the most thoughtful about their engagement with children, especially when you're like starting a new relationship and you meet someone and they have children, I feel like the people who've told me, okay, like we sat down and really talked about like, who will I be to this child? Will I be a fun uncle? Will I be a co-parent? Do I want to work towards co-parenting? All of those folks who've ever told me those stories are all polyamorous.
That's great. Yes, because it forces you to think about what is this role I'm going to have? What are we constructing here? So it does take this very conscious attempt at family building.
Right. And I've even known people, like I knew someone who wanted to have a baby and their primary partner was like, I don't want to be a parent. And so they sat down, they wrote a lot of things down, and they really negotiated what role this person would have in the baby's life. And of course, to the outside world, they're like, what do you mean your partner, the person you love, the person you live with is having a baby and you're not the co-parent? Well, that's kind of the default setting, but we don't actually right. have to accept the default setting.
Absolutely, because one size does not fit all. Sometimes right. that default was constructed for a personality type or a family style or a time that just doesn't work.
Plus, you have good data on there actually being other advantages, like even more practical advantages to polyamorous families. Tell me about those.
Absolutely. The resource sharing is significant. So time, for instance, when you have multiple adults you can rely on, there's more time for each individual adult to work for money, or get an education, or get some exercise, or sleep, and date, you know, or go out and see other people, whatever, have a social life. But the polyamorous parents I've spoken to are not necessarily trying to date a ton. They will often have, you know, two partners seems like a pretty common range, maybe three. But they're not, you know, hosting orgies every weekend and...
Who has the time? Who has the energy?
Exactly. Like what they're doing is folding laundry together while they watch Netflix and, you know, like try to figure out who's going to help the kid with the Zoom homework this coming week. You know, they're very mundane in some respects. But that mundanity turns out to be really helpful when you've got four people and somebody's got to earn money and somebody else wants to go to school and somebody, you know, wants to take a nap. All right.
Well, and this reminds me of, you know, we, and there are cultures that still do this in the United States, but, you know, we originally had intergenerational families all living under one roof. We had sort of much more communal parenting. And then, you know, the construction of the nuclear family came along and it isolated everyone into their little boxes, their little box houses. And in fact, it's hard to raise a kid with just two or even one parent.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And it's not, I mean, we kind of give lip service to it takes a village to raise a child. But then when people actually construct that village, some people get all freaked out about it, you know, assuming it will be harmful. When they don't assume, like the kid will be harmed by having a babysitter and a grandmother and the parents around, plus an auntie or something, you know, mm-hmm. That's fine. But somehow the fact that the adults are having sex with each other freaks them out when the kids often don't notice, frequently don't care. And as soon as they know, they're like, no, we don't want to talk about that. We don't know, you know, like you do your adult thing and gross. Parents having sex, gross. And we talk about something else.
I mean, we need to change that piece of it too. We need to know that our parents are sexual people. And, you know, we need to sort of stop pretending and turning away from that. I mean, that's part of a larger conversation just around open conversations about sex and sexuality within families and around the dinner table. And in a way that normalizes those conversations just as much as you would talk about anything else.
And actually, that's another benefit that the kids mention, that they can ask questions, not only about sex and sexuality, but about all sorts of different things, the free flow of information, and that their homes often do become a center of sex positivity and scientific-based information about sexuality. So their friends, for instance, if they've got a question about whatever sexual thing they can't talk to their own parents about, and everybody knows the internet, I mean, it's great for pornography, but pornography is not great for developing a realistic expectation of that's how your partner is going to look and act, and that's how sex between people actually works. So to be able to come and speak to actual humans that know about these things, the parents in polyamorous families often then offer kind of sex positive support to the teens in their lives who don't have other sources of information about that.
I think it's so powerful to be that person, right? Whether you're an aunt, a trusted adult figure, or you're actually a parent who your kid could come to with anything, right? The person you go to when you're like, I might have an STI, or the person you go to when you say, I think I might want to be having intercourse for the first time. Like, what are the things that I should know? Or, you know, the person who's like, oh, you need birth control? I'll help you get that. Or you need an abortion? I'll help you get that. I think everyone in their life needs a grown-up like that.
Absolutely. Somebody to count on. And especially someone who will tell you the truth, I think, is crucial. And something many polyamorous families are really good at. This emphasis on honesty and communication in polyamorous relationships among adults then tends to really inflect the parenting style, that polyamorous parents tend to be really honest with their kids and work on communication. In fact, one of the things the kids really like about that is sometimes that means their parents admitting that they're wrong. And there's this old school style of parenting that the father knows best, you mm-hmm. know, is mm-hmm. always right. And mom is too, somewhat less so than dad, but adults are always right. They never screw up. You can never question them. They never have to apologize. And having a family style where people communicate honestly, they work on compassion with each other, and they take responsibility when they make mistakes, actually translates to very positive relationships with the adult children. So polyamorous kids who grew up in polyamorous families and now they're in their 20s and 30s, they feel like they can talk to their parents. They can trust their parents. They can have more adult relationships with their parents because the parents aren't still treating them like they're eight or something, you know?
Right.
When they were eight, they were honest, but they can have, you know, more honest and realistic communication that builds a lifetime relationship.
Okay, I want to talk more about honesty, but we're going to take our first commercial break.
Okay.
Don't go anywhere, folks. More with Dr. Eli Sheff when we get back. 2021 is a time for new beginnings, hopefully. And it's probably time to bring a new attitude to the bedroom. Like a Kitten's Couple Box has everything you need to make this Valentine's Day unforgettable. The box is like a one-stop shop for all your essential, sexy V-Day needs. Don't waste hours getting lube and researching erotic games and then maybe some lingerie and some chocolate and all the things you want to put together for your loved one. Just grab a couple's box and you'll be set up for a spectacular night. I got to try out all the goodies. There's a little piece of lingerie, chocolate CBD body paint, lots of fun, strawberry lube, a 10-speed heart vibe, and a dual arousal cock ring. You know, for my playmate, the games were the most fun. There are these sex scratcher tickets and also a really great card game, which helps you explore different desires and fantasies. I mean, no matter how long you've been together, I'm telling you, we played the game, we had a blast, and we even got to hear new things about each other, which made for some great sex. I want to tell you, this is a great gift box, especially for couples who are ready to, say, get your first sex toys or go deeper in your relationship by sharing fantasies. Also, a portion of all sales go to charities that focus on women's empowerment, education, and health. And I've got a deal for you. Right now, Like a Kitten is offering our listeners 20% off and free shipping when you go to likeakitten.com/Tristan. Or you can enter code Tristan at checkout. Just go to likeakitten.com/Tristan. Or use promo code Tristan to get 20% off your order. likeakitten.com/Tristan. Have a great Valentine's Day, everyone. Welcome back to Sex Out Loud, everyone. I'm talking to one of the foremost experts in polyamory, Dr. Eli Sheff, who's a researcher, a speaker, an academic, an educational consultant. And her newest work is Children in Polyamorous Families. So Eli, one of the things that we talked about before the break was honesty, like more honesty in relationships and specifically in polyamorous families. But there is a conundrum I've always known about, which is you tell your kids, hey, this is a different kind of family. That's all. You know how your friend has two dads and you know how your friend has like two moms and two dads and you know how your friend has their grandmother's raising them, right? It's a different kind of a family. So that's, you know, in very basic general terms that people can understand. But then depending on how out the family is about being polyamorous, you may have to tell your kids, oh, this is totally great and it's totally normal, but don't tell anyone else. Which those two things are in conflict with each other. I mean, it's confusing. It could be confusing to a kid.
It is. And the way some polyamorists explain that, it's crucial that they do it without shame. I think it's shame that then makes the kids feel like, oh, if we're supposed to be ashamed of this, maybe we're doing something wrong. Maybe there is something wrong with my family. And so I've spoken to many polyamorous parents who handle this by saying, not to be ashamed of it, but that we are different, or that there are some things that are private. You know how, like, when you go to school, you wear clothes. But when you're at home, if you don't want to have clothes on, it's totally fine to be naked at home. But you don't go to school without clothes on because being naked is a private thing. There's nothing wrong with being naked. You don't have to be ashamed of your body. But it's a private thing to do at home. Or, like, you know how grandma gets upset when we say those words that she thinks are bad? And in our family, they're just words. We can say those words. It's not that big of a deal. But saying them in front of grandma, she gets upset about those words. So we just don't say them in front of her because it would hurt her feelings. It would upset her. So just like we don't say those words in front of grandma, we don't talk about dad's boyfriend in front of grandma because it would upset her. And just like we don't go to school naked, we don't talk about the family at school because it's private. So the emphasis, it's okay to have some things that are private, but the emphasis is on privacy and not shame. And also then balancing it with opportunities where it is okay to talk about it. So finding polyamorous community with other poly families who are, you know, have kids, and letting the kids just have free reign in that setting to talk about it as much as they want to anybody in that setting.
Right. And also, but it also seems to me as they get older, you sort of have to explain like stigma and just like society sort of constraints on people. Right. And even maybe mononormativity, maybe you won't use those words. but the expectation that everyone is in a certain kind of family and we're in a different family. And if you tell people that, they might discriminate against you. They might not be friends with you anymore. Their parents might say you can't come over anymore. I think that's hard for a kid to digest.
Absolutely. And in fact, kids kind of intuitively understand that because so much of the media around them shows families with just two parents or shows, you know, people bullying others for being different. So mm-hmm. I think kids often know that it can be dangerous to be different and have a kind of a sense of selective disclosure is what I've called it, that they... Mm-hmm. In some situations are like, I don't feel safe talking about this, or I'm just going to be vague, or I'm going to change the topic, or I'm, you know, like distract from this.
Are there other challenges that children of polyamorous families face?
Outside of stigma?
Yeah, stigma, who to tell, who not to tell.
I would say sometimes the complexity of the family turns into a disadvantage for them. Trying to kind of manage all those multiple parents with all their different relationships with each other, and especially when the relationship breaks up. Mm. One kid was talking to me about the dissolution of what used to be a quad and is now two of those original members are together and the other two have peeled off. So it was like two pretty significant divorces that the entire family went through. And so the kid called that divorce on steroids.
Right, right.
Because they were two pretty, like, you know, each of the partners that ended up staying together divorced their spouses. And because they had blended the family, each divorce hit both sets of kids.
Right. Oh, right. Right, right, right. And you say in the book, you also have studied kids who grew up in polyamorous families rather than who, like, again, like if two people got together and already had kids and they were also polyamorous. So they grew up under some kind of non-monogamous family to begin with. And then they sort of had to make the transition. So your research though is on people who like started from go.
Pretty much. Although like one family I can think of, the children were born into a monogamous family, but when the youngest child was about 3, the mother's boyfriend moved in. And so, you know, the kid doesn't really remember before that.
Mm. So
that child wasn't necessarily born into a polyamorous family. They don't really have a lot of memory of before.
Right, right. I want to shift gears a little bit because I know you've been working with the team that developed this new project called the Bonding Project.
Yes.
It's an app that can help people figure out what kind of relationship style works best for them. And it launched in beta recently. So tell me about how you got involved with this.
This was originally the brainchild of Jess Wise, who is this amazing sex positive woman in Los Angeles. She's an entrepreneur. And she wanted a test she could give her potential partners to be like, look, can you deal with multiple partnership or not? I kind of don't want to mess with you if you can't. So can we have some kind of test that you can take right off the bat to see if you could even go there or not? And it's a kind of almost like a Myers-Briggs-ish test, except that the Bonding Project is based deeply in science. So after Jess and I started talking and we brought on 2 more team members and I started looking at the research behind relationship satisfaction in consensually non-monogamous relationships, turned out to be the rich vein of research, in part because a lot of that compares to monogamous relationships, so I didn't have to research them independently, and then looks at different kinds of non-monogamy. So I identified the factors that lead to satisfaction in consensually non-monogamous relationships and monogamous relationships. And then we wrote questions related to that. And one of the really unusual things I would say about this test is that it's very nuanced.
It's so nuanced. So I was like, these are my choices? Wow. I don't think I've ever had these choices on another survey.
So what kinds of choices, for instance?
Yeah, because it was like, instead of saying like strongly agree, strongly disagree, neutral, right? Or which is kind of a common thing, or you put it on a scale. It was like, somewhat agree. Yeah, would be open to thinking about that. Or like mostly disagree, but might consider it.
Right.
Right.
Right. Those evolved over many months of trying out all sorts of different things because, well, at first, as we talked about it, we realized it's hard to answer questions about relationships frequently because it often depends on who you're with and and what mood you're in or what, you know, like which partner you're talking about or what acts or whatever that how things are going with you and things like that. So at first we had a drop-down menu of it depends and with like, it depends on what partner and how good the sex is. And if I have an STI and, you know, like all the, and we, so we were trying to think of all these things it would depend on. And the drop-down menu became incredibly unwieldy. It was just not at all possible to have an it depends because it depends on so many things. So we were like, all right, we've got to have some way to be like it depends, but this is the main feeling here. So also the test doesn't come straight out and say, all right, this one, here's your one result.
Yes, yes.
Talks about, oh, you might be comfortable with this. You might be curious. You might be cautious, or you might find this challenging.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
You have different levels of you know, ways it might impact you and different kinds of bonding. One of the things we realized with other relationship tests we looked at was that there was often no room for a solo bonder, someone who wants relationships but doesn't necessarily want to organize their life around one romantic partner.
This is a fault of society, right? This is also a fault of society and the whole notion that people who are single don't want to be single. And that's why I think solo polyamory is such a great style for people, because I feel like it gives them way more agency saying, actually, this is how I run my life. This is how, these are my choices. This is what I want, rather than I'm still looking for that one, which just buys into all that monogamous mythology.
Totally.
We're going to take our final commercial break. I took the test from the Bonding Project, and Eli and I are going to talk about my results when we get back. So don't go anywhere. Everything going on in the world is a lot. The calendar may have flipped over to 2021, but that doesn't mean that much. Most of us are still experiencing inordinate amounts of stress. We could all benefit from ways to reduce that stress and get more sleep. It's so important to take care of ourselves and invest in our well-being, especially now. Over 85 million people around the world use Calm to take care of their minds and get better sleep. Calm has a whole library of programs designed for healthy sleep, like soundscapes, guided meditations, and over 100 sleep stories narrated by soothing voices like Stephen Fry, Kelly Rowland, and Laura Dern. For me, better sleep is one really important ingredient for a better day. For listeners of the show, Calm is offering a special limited time promotion of 40% off a Calm premium subscription at calm.com/Tristan. That's 40% off, unlimited access to Calm's entire library with new content added every week. Get started today at calm.com/Tristan. That's calm, calm.com/TRISTAN for 40% off a premium subscription. Welcome back to Sex Out Loud. I'm talking today with Dr. Elizabeth Eli Sheff, who's a researcher, an expert witness, a coach, a speaker, and an educational consultant. She is an expert on polyamory and also on relationships. And so it wasn't a surprise that she got involved with this new app, which can help people figure out what kind of relationship style works best for them. It's called the Bonding Project. It's now in beta. So I took the test at the Bonding Project, and here are my results. Okay, here's what they gave me. I am challenged with a form of one-to-one bonding. That makes sense. I'm comfortable with a form of one-to-many bonding. I'm curious with a form of many-to-many bonding, and I'm curious with a form of solo bonding. This is funny because right now in my life, I identify as solo polyamorous, and this only thinks I'm curious about it.
Oh, interesting.
Well, because you also were supposed to think of like, you know what I mean? Like relationships you want, right? Right. Not just the relationships you have. So I thought that was interesting. But what does this say? Besides it says I'm not monogamous, what does this say about me?
Well, it said that you were comfortable with one to many.
Mm-hmm.
So we've noticed that as a strong trend in our data, that a lot of people seem to be really interested in the idea of kind of having multiple relationships with multiple people, but all of those relationships being more kind of on their own, rather than, for instance, many to many, which it's, if I remember correctly, Tristan, you were curious.
I was only curious about that. Yes.
we're finding that not as many people are claiming that or are gravitating that as their primary relating style, which makes sense because having, you know, a group relationship with everyone having, you know, equal say in what car you buy and how to raise the kids and who does the dishes, you know, that's more complicated, I guess I would say. So it doesn't surprise me that you might feel more comfortable with one to many, but still curious about many to many, because I think also we have a hunger for community and that desire to feel like part of the many, like accepted and valued and a treasured part of a group. That's something that I think a lot of people crave, and it's hard to find and hard to sustain. So some people who incorporate that as a romantic or a sexual or a lifestyle orientation, if they can find that and sustain it, it's fantastic.
Yeah. Yes.
And the solo bonding, I wonder why you didn't score
higher
with that. Yeah.
Well,
maybe would you really like to be more firmly bonded?
So solo is new for me. And I haven't practiced it before, like over my lifespan. So I'm just sort of settling into it. And I don't know that I'm ready to make like a lifetime commitment to it or to myself, I guess, as my main partner. Yeah, I mean, but I also wonder if I'm just defaulting to like, I have mostly had a primary partner and then other partners, and if that feels like most comfortable to me. So I don't know if I'm in a situation where I'm solo poly for this like stretch of my life, or if that might be what fits best for me. I kind of haven't decided yet, I think.
Well, that then makes a lot of sense that you're curious about it. You're like, is this right? Is this for me? I'm doing it. And how's it going?
Yeah.
Yeah, that makes complete sense, actually. And I didn't mean to imply when I said more firmly bonded that solo polyamorous or solo bonders are not firmly bonded.
Right.
Misspoke.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. I mean, the first thing that comes to mind when I saw this was, oh God, if only everyone took this test. and also had to take it every decade, right? Because things change and desires change. You know, absolutely. I'm just imagining like, what if this was part of sex education in high school, right? Because we often don't talk enough about relationships that are outside the sort of normative framework. And the idea that like this would be put forward in the same way that like we would say, oh, sexuality and sexual orientation is a spectrum. You could be this, you could be this, you could be this. People are this, people are this. The idea of like giving this to high school students and being like, hey, yeah, answer these questions, you know, just trust your gut on your instincts. I mean, it's sort of, it could be mind-blowing for some people.
Absolutely. And I think the chances of working it into average sex education are unfortunately zero, because average education in this country sucks, rocks. It's the worst.
Yeah.
But maybe it didn't even occur to me that we could do that, but we could offer it. For instance, the Unitarian Universalists have a fantastic sex education
program. Oh, and they've been doing it for so long. Their OWL program is an amazing training program.
Awesome.
They're great.
So we should totally say although it's for people 18 and older right now.
I wonder just because that. Yeah. Does it have to be reworded for like the tweens and the teens? Because they're just thinking about what they want.
Yeah.
But also monogamy is a part of this survey, right? That's the other really important thing to get across to people is it's like the test we wish we had, right? that so many people default to monogamy because that's the only model they see. It's happening around them. That's what you're quote unquote supposed to do. That's the adult thing, you know, you have to settle down. And so I love the idea that we can sort of deprogram people and say, hey, actually, like before you even get into a relationship, why not take this test? Because I think it would help clarify for people who maybe spend time in monogamy, which doesn't work and which can be painful when it doesn't work, just starting out with the test. That's why it's so funny. The origin story is that the person who came up with it wanted to like give the test to potential suitors. Like, can we get this out of the way first? Because there are some things that are just deal breakers for me.
Right. We need to see how well we match.
Right. But so many people haven't even considered it. So that's the other thing. I want this to be in Cosmo magazine. I mean, not that Cosmo is the arbitrator of all good things, but I want this to be in the mainstream. Like I want people to be thinking about this beyond people who are already have already considered or practiced non-monogamy. That would be like my wish for it, is that it's in all these women's magazines, it's in self-help books, it's an exercise for everyone.
I'm thrilled you enjoyed it so much, Tristan, that you see it as that useful. We worked so hard on it, and it's had so many different iterations that this one we're feeling really confident about. And it's the beta project that will have probably one last iteration before it turns into a downloadable app on the phone.
Right. But you can take the quiz online on the website.
Absolutely. Yeah. You can take it online and it works on your phone if you connect to a website on your phone.
Oh, right. With the browser. Right.
Oh, yeah. It'll work great.
Yeah. It just seems like time for this. And also it's a conversation starter. It seems to me like there were questions that I knew the answer to right away. And there are other questions where I was like, what would I like most in that scenario? And so being able to sort of present a scenario to a partner or a potential partner and say like, what is this for you? Is this super important? Is it not that important? Are you open to it? Like, where do you fall in this spectrum? I think could be good fodder for people to like clarify their relationship goals.
Absolutely. And eventually, ideally, where if we can figure out the computer things on the back end, what we're hoping to move towards is to allow an entire polycule, like everyone within the polycule, to take it and compare their results and see where the polycule is strong and where maybe they have some disagreements or where they might have some issues, for instance.
Yeah. Yeah. Along with, you know, just getting your charts done astrologically, this could be a wealth of information. I'm into astrology. Absolutely. Not everyone's into astrology, but just to give you a baseline for like where things are at and what you seem like in agreement with and what is like, oh, we have different ideas about that.
Definitely. Yes. And we will, you know, even when we have that coming forth, we're also going to have more tests in the future. Once we really perfect this initial test. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. There's a lot more to, for instance, there's all sorts of different ways to have a one-to-many relationship and being able to kind of suss that out. What are the different ways and how to, see multiplicity within that.
Right.
So lots of different ways to have a solo relationship. Some people don't want sex and romance to be part of their relationship, but they really want emotional connection and community and support, you know, and that's a legitimate form of solo bonding as well.
Yeah. I mean, this just really appeals to me also because I'm a fan of like checklists. I'm a fan of quizzes. I'm a fan of like giving people material tools to, and then also revisiting those, right? As things change and as things shift, because they're dynamic. Yeah. But I'm a fan of like giving someone an actual thing to say, here's how to begin a discussion about either you've reached a point of conflict or there's some kind of communication missing. That's like my jam. So that appeals to my brain also.
So much. Yeah, that they're fun too. And one of the good things about this test is it takes like 10 minutes.
Yeah, yeah.
Maybe 12 if you have to really think about some of the questions, which they can be thought-provoking questions.
Yeah. No, well, you told us to trust our gut, but there were ones that I was like, it's this. And then there are other ones where I was like, huh, what is it? So I agree with that, that it's like takes different amounts of time per question.
Well, and another good thing about it is it's free. You can take it as many times as you want and never be charged.
Right. We love that.
Oh, yeah.
Well, I can't wait to see the final iteration and then where this bonding project takes us next. Thank you so much.
You're very excited.
For talking to me about all of this stuff today.
Thanks so much for having me on, Tristan. I always love coming on your show. You're just interesting and fun to talk to.
Thank you. The book is called Children in Polyamorous Families. It's available from Amazon, on Kindle, and other online stores. The app is in beta at bondingproject.com. Eli is at elizabethchef.com. Elizabeth is with an S, like Sam. And her last name is spelled S-H-E-F-F. She also writes a blog called The Polyamorists Next Door on Psychology Today, which you can find there. And she's on Facebook and Twitter at Dr. Eli Chef. I want to do a shout out to my editor and engineer, A-Rod at FTC Designs. He's been working overtime on the show, and I really appreciate him. You can follow him on Twitter or hire him to do your podcast at FTC_designs. Reminder that new episodes of the show go up on podcast platforms on Mondays. If you feel so moved to write a review of the show, that really helps people find it. And I welcome your feedback, except when you say you hate my voice. No, please feel free. Free speech forever. Thanks for taking the time to say that. You can find me on social media across all platforms at Tristan Taramino. And until next time, take some time to talk about sex out loud.